You're listening to Crazy Shit in Real Estate. You'll be amazed at all these wild but true situations that others have found themselves in. Because on this show, you'll hear uncensored, unbelievable stories from the world of real estate. I'm Lee Brown. Let's dive right in.
Before you get the rest of the story, I'd love to share a quick message from today's sponsor.
Hey, y'all. Just going to take a quick break from this conversation to let you know about the sponsor of today's episode. That sponsor is, well, frankly, it's me. It's Lee Brown University. Look, it's no secret that real estate is crazy competitive, getting more so every day. And when the pie doesn't get any bigger, but the people wanting a piece of it do, you've got to figure out a competitive advantage. And that's why I created Lee Brown University. It's everything you need from soup to nuts, cradle to grave, point A to point B, whatever point B is. Each of you has different goals. So maybe you're a new to the career realtor, or you're a super experienced pro who can't figure out that next level. There's something in my course that's going to help you break through. It's designed for you before I even met you. So enroll in Lee Brown University today. You go to www.leebrownu.com and I'll see you there. Now, back to this amazing content.
Hello, friends. I'm Lee Brown. And if I look a little bit strung out, it's because our next guest talked so fast and dropped so much information that I'm going to have to go back and listen to this episode a couple of times myself. I've got Mike Butler for you. He is an investor in Louisville, Kentucky, who's got, just all I can say is hang on. I'll see you on the other side. Tell our people where you're located and give them a little bit of backstory on Mike, because I know they want to hear the details of how all of that could be theirs. But I'm just going to point out that as a detective, you are already no stranger to hard work and doing the research. And spoiler alert, friends, Mike's going to tell you that there's going to be research and hard work involved in building that mailbox money. But anyway, tell them where you're located, Mike. Give them a little background.
I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, and I grew up in the south end of Louisville, where Churchill Downs is, home of the Kentucky Derby.
Nice.
Blue-collar neighborhood. None of the kids I went to grade school with, none of their parents were educated professionals, CPAs, attorneys, doctors. They all had jobs like at factories, or they worked for a plumber or something like that. The ones I admired were the mom-and-pop business owners. They might have a bakery on the corner, or they own a hardware store or something. And so I really didn't get a taste of real estate until I actually got on the police department. But anyway, oldest of seven kids. And so I didn't have lifestyle of the rich and famous is where I watched to see what I'd like to be. But I wanted more. We grew up poor. I remember people from church bringing over boxes of used shoes. And us kids would go through them trying to see which ones fit and which one we liked. And I liked that pair and this and that. And I knew what was going on. We just didn't have a lot of money. Right. And I sure didn't want to raise my kids that way. So I've always been self-driven and had a lot of enthusiasm, but just couldn't find out where to work smarter, not harder. And so we went to a private grade school, and then I got a paper route in the seventh grade so I could pay for my PhD, my private high school diploma. So if you've heard of Larry Goins, he calls it public high school diploma. I said, well, I got a paper route for my private high school diploma. And so we got that, and I passed it on to all my younger brothers and sisters so they could do the same. And so when I became a policeman, I thought all of my peers, well, I was in uniform, then plain clothes. Then I went to the long-term undercover doing murder for hire, contract killing, organized crime. That's what I specialized in.
In Louisville. We don't talk about Louisville as being contract killing location.
Yeah, but I was in the criminal ignorance unit, intelligence unit, I'm sorry. And so what we did is we networked on a regional basis with other intelligence units, Nashville, Indianapolis, Chicago, Cincinnati, St. Louis. And so what we would do is we would use these undercover people like me in different cities. And so that worked out very, very well. And then not long about the year 1999, that we were working a group of organized crime, and they put a contract out to kill me. And my bosses heard it. I was wired up and doing undercover stuff. And our confidential informant said, hey, they're not going to steal a whole trailer load of brand new Corvettes and bring them to you. They're going to track you down and kill you because they'll know you have the cash in your pocket. So the bosses heard that. And they called my wife and all this. And my wife freaked out and said, well, it's your job or family. And at that time, my real estate was making about eight times more than my job income. So I made a decision and retired early. because of my real estate. And boy, it just exploded from there. And what's interesting, when I got started, I had less than $1,000 in the police officer's credit union. My wife was in nursing school. We had two beautiful daughters. And back then, the market, I'm not going to say the market's identical to what it is today, but as far as the financing goes, the available financing, if you wanted to borrow money to buy a rental property, they wanted 25% down. I didn't have that. So I had to figure, I knew something in my gut told me if I could get three rental houses on my old paper route, three little two-bedroom houses on my old paper route, and let the tenants pay for it, put a little money in my pocket every month. By the time I was ready to retire, I could double my police pension. And because I saw some people had 20 years on, they get ticked off at a young boss, right, throw up that favorite middle finger. And then I would see them working, driving a golf cart on a graveyard shift at Churchill Downs, guarding horse barns and horses. I said, Al, what are you doing that for? He says, I can't live on my pension. I went, uh-oh. So that motivated me to do something else. And I didn't want to trade my hours for dollars. I got two younger brothers that are on the police department, and they would work off duty jobs. And even if they make back then, say 20 or 25 bucks an hour, which was good, well, half of that, they're going to have to pay an income tax. They couldn't comprehend that. And so I didn't want to trade my hours for dollars. I wanted to do something now that would grow and compound. And when I found out how easy it was, my wife put the invisible shock collar on me. And she says, all right, too good to be true. It probably is. You got to sit on these two houses for a year. And we had a dedicated savings account we didn't touch, put the real estate in there. And then after about, well, after that year, I had 8,000 in there. So then I went out and started buying more houses. And then I set a goal. I was like, well, how many houses would it take to have a full-time office person? How many houses would it take to have a full-time maintenance guy? And so I did that. And I'm just like, well, holy cow, if it's going to do that, if I need to buy 100 houses, why don't I just do it this year and get it over with? So I set a goal to buy 100 houses a year, and I broke it down into baby steps, and I had to average 2.25 deals per week.
Okay, let's back this up a minute, because you are speeding down the highway like you're in a high-speed chase right now. You are so down there. And we got to break this down for our listeners, because my listeners are a mix of regular people and also realtors, so they're all over the place. But let's go back to those first three rental properties that you bought. Of course, the smartest thing you did was land on your paper route, because you knew that location, you knew the geography, you probably had some kind of recognition of the neighbors and the houses. So you had some starting.
I was scared.
Well, of course you're scared, but you're not scared where you start. So let's talk about the very first one. You didn't have any cash. You didn't really know what you were doing. So how did you overcome that emotion of fear? Because it absolutely is what paralyzes most people from getting involved in investing. They watch too much television and they think they're going to have a terrible tenant, and they forget that owning rental real estate is actually the way that you can be one of the people in your area that provides good housing for your neighbors. So how do you get over the fear to make that first house happen? And how did you get creative enough to make the financing happen?
Well, the way that I got creative to make finance happen, prior to being on the police department, I worked my way up real quick to be a store manager at Winn-Dixie. And they moved me to Madisonville, Kentucky. It's a coal mining area. I didn't like that. And so then I got robbed. They would send me to problem stores and I turn them around. And one of the problem stores was in a bad neighborhood. And I turned that around. I got robbed down there. I forget what year date. I used to have it memorized. But anyway, that sparked my interest in law enforcement, going to court and catching thieves that were stealing and all. And I said, wow, that's pretty good. And then they would hire off-duty policemen to work in my store. And they didn't do anything. Well, I had a ton of stress in the corporate world. And the farther up you go, the thinner the ice. So I got on the police department, took a 50% cut in pay. And in my gut, I felt like real estate was the thing that I needed to learn about. So I moved back to Louisville, got on the police department. And what I started doing, Lee, was doing my due diligence to learn the market of, let's say, my paper route properties.
So what did you want to learn? What exactly were those metrics and data points? Was it the price of the house? Was it the amount of the rents? Was it the demographics of who lived there? What were your checklist items?
Well, this is all pre-internet, pre-email, and pre-anything, okay? And the Sunday paper would list properties that were sold. It would list properties that were for sale. And then also they would have a little ad from HUD, and they called those HUD houses. And you could get a paper packet to bid on those as an owner-occupant, and you'd deliver them to the federal courthouse. That's all since changed since back then. But if you were an investor, you had to give 10 days priority to owner-occupants. And so I just brushed up on the market values, learning that, watching the rents, watching what properties are selling for. And I mean, still to this day, every house on my paper route on that street and stuff, I can still see it. I can see every house even today. And so I learned that market like the back of my hand. When I moved back from Madisonville, didn't want to rent. So I bought a house. It was on the corner of my paper route and it had pigeons living in it. And there was two investors who bought it and they tried to rent it out on Section 8 and trying to put it on autopilot. And it was a disaster. And so the house was wrecked. It was destroyed, everything like that. And my dad, when I was growing up, he taught me how to change the oil in his truck so I could save money when I get my truck and change oil in my truck myself. So I was warped in that department, the rich dad, poor dad thing.
Absolutely. Best book ever. Every kid should play the cash flow game and every parent should do exactly what Mike's talking about. Let your kids change your oil, change the tires. It's good information to have.
Yeah, but that was, so I was raised with, I can buy a fixer upper and I can do all the work. Well, that's not where you want to be a superstar investor.
But it is where you start, because if you're going to supervise somebody else, you better the heck know what you're supervising.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was looking at fixer uppers. And so this house was for sale. Remember, I was watching that Sunday paper, and even doing this when I lived in Madison, I was still watching all that stuff. So I can't remember what they were asking for the house, but it had a first mortgage on it with PNC Bank, which then was Citizens Fidelity. And these were two investors that apparently their relationship fell apart and they didn't want to mess with that rental. It was destroyed. They couldn't sell it on a retail market because it wouldn't pass anybody's inspection and they didn't want to put any money in it. So I made them an offer, and I don't remember what it was, but I made them an offer where I would take over payments of their first mortgage. And then what would be the equivalent of a down payment? I said, okay, I'll give you this much for it, but this amount of money, you're going to have to sell or finance, and I'm going to pay you so much a month, and it's going to start in 6 months. No payments for 6 months, because I only got $1,000 and I need that $1,000 to buy materials to fix this house up. And it's going to take me that long before I can get it fixed up. So amazingly, they said, okay.
So just to back that up, the seller financing that they agreed to was for the down payment. And then you took over the payments on their existing mortgage.
Yes. They had to make payments on that first mortgage for 6 months too.
Sure.
So I had just basically closing costs was my skin in the game. And this was definitely a motivated seller. You just can't walk down the street and find deals like this every day. But this was a home that I fixed up and I moved my family into. And I think I bought it for mid-20s. And I had a brother-in-law who was a real estate agent. And I sold it for $41,000. He says, you'll never get 41 for it. That's too high. Well, I got 41 for it. I added a bathroom. I fixed it up. And so then I bought a brand new house. And I was on the police department at that time. And so I'm like, man, this is pretty cool. So then I started watching. I wanted to buy a rental house and one popped up on my old paper route. My youngest daughter still remembers this to this day because we pulled up in the driveway in my old Ford Ranger pickup. You could smell the inside of the house from the driveway. It stunk that bad. So I bought it. I bought it for $17,000 and hocked everything I had, my 77 Monte Carlo and my old Ford Ranger pickup. I got loans on those at the credit union. I maxed out my credit cards and scrambled up enough money to pay cash for it. And then I did all the work. I fixed it up in 13 days and put a new water heater in it, new bathroom, blah, blah, blah. And I did all the work myself. So then I made a decision. Well, in a month or so, I'm going to start getting some payments that I can't make because I maxed out everything. Mm-hmm. And so I either got to sell it fast or get my money back. I said, well, let's try to get my money back. And because I like the idea of what else can you buy where somebody else can pay for it? It's going to put money in your pocket and hopefully it goes up in value. And there was something I never understood was that 7 or 8 syllable word called depreciation. Not in my mind at all. Had no idea what it was. So I got out the yellow pages If you don't know what those are, that's
I kind of miss the days of the newspaper and the yellow pages, Mike. That was so much simpler.
Yeah. And so I went through the yellow pages, just calling banks and see if they could give me a loan. A lot of them didn't want to touch rental property. And the ones that did, they wanted like 25% down of your purchase price, not what it's appraised for. So remember, I bought it for $17. I probably put about $2,500 in it. Well, Charlie Ackerman, bless his heart, he's dead now. He was the last bank that I called, and it was called Cumberland. And today it's known as Fifth Third Bank. Fifth Third Bank bought out Cumberland. And Charlie says, yep, I can give you 80% of what it appraises for. And I'm like, is that legal? Nobody else is doing that. So anyways, I had to pay for the appraisal up front. They took care of all the closing costs. It appraised for $30,000. And I had roughly 20 in it.
You felt like a king, didn't you?
Oh, I was scared to death he was doing something illegal. So while that loan was being processed to refinance it, and things went faster back then, the house across the street, which is identical because they were all built in this subdivision after World War II. And so I saw people move out. I saw people go over and fix it up. Then they put a for sale sign there, said Melton Investments. So I called him up. He was selling it for $26,000. Mine just appraised for $30,000 and it's across the street identical. So I made a deal with him with seller financing. Now I've got a tenant in both of them and went back to Charlie, said, hey, I got another one. Can I do that? And he says, yeah, come on. Hit two appraisals for $30,000. And now I'm sitting there and I've got about, it appraises for 30, got 24, and 24 was the first, the super low interest rate, low payments, I mean, anyway. Oh, I was making probably $150 a month on each one, positive cash flow. And when both refis were done, I'm sitting there with maybe $4,000 or $5,000 in a bank account. So that savings account that was dedicated to real estate, my wife said, nah, looks like too good to be true, probably is. So she made me sit for a year, and that $4,000 or $5,000 grew into $8,000 with the positive cash flow and stuff. And so she said, okay, you can go buy some more. But how did I overcome my fear? I would say I overcame my fear by having a foundation of knowledge, understanding the market, the prices, this and that. I started off in a neighborhood that I felt comfortable with, that if anything happened to that house, I would be able to fix it with these hands. So you're talking two bedroom, 800 square foot house. Now, you know, I'm not looking at three and four bedroom, two bath and fireplaces and all this other stuff. I mean, this is just a plain old simple, not even a, maybe a first time home buyer, low level home. And so I felt comfortable putting my feet in the water, both feet, and taking a chance there. And so when I got those things refied, I paid off all those credit cards, paid off the loan on the 77 Monte Carlo and the Ford Ranger and all that. And that's how I got started.
And so an important thing to note there about what you did at that step was you did not leave the debt hanging over you. You went ahead and made sure that debt was retired before you took your next steps. Because we do see a lot of investors that get to over leverage space and they never go back and retire the debt. They just keep going forward. You can, but when the markets make a shift, you can be the one that's left high and dry. If you're being methodical about retirement of debt before you take on more, before you make your higher, check your cash flow, there's so many different ways you can always move forward because, spoiler alert, the market's going to change. We're already seeing stabilization in it now, which I'm grateful for. I like a stable market. The frothy market was wild, but it's always a good time to buy a house if the numbers work, if the metrics work, and depending on the market, and that all depends on you. So you should never listen to a realtor, by the way, listeners, who tells you it's always a good time to buy. It depends on you and depends on your metrics and what you need. But if you're also the person who says, well, there's no point because I can't buy a house for $17,000 like Mike did, you have to remember that buying a house today for $180,000, your kids are going to look back on that 20 years from now and say, man, you got a house for that, because it's all in perspective.
Well, so I mean, I can not fudge my story and adapt it to today's market by using the real numbers. But if you really want to use real numbers, just add a zero.
Exactly.
Because the percentages are still there. And so you can add a zero to that. Oh, you got off on something that I had a brain fart on, but
that retirement of debt, because my episodes stay really short. So I have to keep reeling. You got too much to say, Mike. I got to reel you back in, boy. No wonder your podcast is popular.
Well, let me say this. We talked about corrections in the market. people were over leveraged back 2008, 2009, 2010 with the financial tsunami. Yeah. Here's rule number one. Rule number one, make sure that each deal supports it, can float itself. And if you're growing your business and you're working towards those 20 nice rentals, well, right now it's sort of kind of a perfect storm for financing because you got the lowest interest rates ever on record. And in today's market, or right now, would you borrow $1 million if you could get it for 3% fixed for 30?
Absolutely, I would.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy not to, because what you're going to make is going to outstrip what you're paying for the cost of the money. And it just, this is that age old problem. If you're waiting for prices to go down, you should know that interest rates will go up naturally. If you look at the rate of inflation right now, at some point, interest rates are going to have to rise because inflation is way outstripping where we should be. So prices will settle down probably. We don't know ever what's going to happen in the market, but when rates go up, if prices settle down, you might be in a worse place than you are today with prices high and interest rates down, because nothing exists in a vacuum. And I think a lot of people get that tunnel vision, right? They heard about the interest rates and they saw it's a bid more and said, I'm going to stay out of that. But then they look back a few years later and say, oh man, I should have.
Well, just look at the investors who bought rental properties 5 years ago. And look what has happened in the last 5 years.
On both ends, right? Because rents are up and the price of property's up. It's wild.
Yes. Yeah, but the values have just skyrocketed. Well, there's going to be an adjustment, and it's the old supply and demand. So right now, there's not enough houses for sale and too many buyers. And with interest rates low, I mean, sellers are getting 3 and 4 offers on a decent house the first day. But here's something that you cannot do in today's market, and I don't think you've ever seen this before either. But we can no longer go on the MLS and find a deal. Now, I can dig and find one, but what you got to master, I don't want you to stop buying. That's when you make your money. Because here's why. There's different reasons. Every deal I've done has had one common denominator, and that's a motivated seller. So what is a motivated seller? That's the people you want to find. It's a person with the authority to sell real estate who has a problem, and selling this real estate will solve all or a major part of the problem. Yep. Those are the folks you need to find. So what are their situations? I'll just rattle off some. This is not all, but divorce, foreclosure, job relocation, empty nesters, kids have grown up, moved out, fire, burnout landlords, you can buy a bundle of them from them.
That's a good audience right there, especially right now.
Yeah. So I don't want you to slow down on your buying. You just got to shift. Your marketing can be free. When you hear marketing, it's different than advertising. Advertising, you're writing checks and spending money. Marketing, if you use your website right, you can attract motivated sellers there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so that's what you need to attract. And you can be proactive about it or you can be reactive. But if you want to get those 20 nice houses paid for in 3 to 5 years, you got to start buying.
And all right, we're going to have to wrap up our episode because mine stay in the 15-minute range, and we already have more information than anybody could ever listen to in 15 minutes because you are like a fire hose. So they're obviously going to want to go to your website. We're going to include all of Mike's links in the show notes for the episode. But Mike, give them one piece of sage advice from the man who bought 84 houses the first year. What's the one thing somebody should read, learn, or do to make themselves start to follow in your footsteps?
Can I do two things?
You're allowed to do two.
Okay. One is going to be the books. Get the book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. It'll change your mindset just on your personal finances. Number two is get my book, Landlording on Autopilot, to give you a sneak peek in this weird brain that I have here between my ears. And then the other is the Investor Pledge. Now, I had my notes ready for your jaw-dropping story, and we didn't get to touch that. And that was about...
Well, go ahead and throw it in, because I thought your story was how you bought all these houses with no money. But go ahead and tell us the story then.
The jaw-dropping story?
Yes.
Okay. Got a house over on my paper route. People lived there 38 years, owner-occupant. The lady had a neighborhood beauty shop in the basement. I'm driving down the street in my police truck, and I see a Coldwell Banker sign on it. It looks brand new. I ignore it. Come back around maybe another 2 months or so. Coldwell Banker sign's still there. Now it's leaning over a little bit. Got grass slung up on the sign from cutting the grass and stuff. It's listed with an agent. So back then we had bag phones. You remember those?
$10 a minute. Had that in my call for emergency.
So I used my bag phone. I called up the agent. I said, is this house still for sale? And her name was Sam Harden. She says, well, you're not going to believe this. We had a contract on it, but it what?
It fell through.
Oh,
Yeah, this was in the early 90s. Okay. Same thing happens today, guys. And so I said, is it vacant? She said, yes. I said, can I have the key code? I'm sitting in front of it right now. So she gives me the key code. I walk through the house. Remember, 38-year owner occupant, very well maintained.
Oh, yeah.
But a butt ugly house. And the floor plan was horrible. So how many times have you walked through a house or a property and said, money pit, I don't want that, no deal here. And you just walk away. So here's what I did. I went ahead and made an offer. What kind of offer? A ridiculous offer. $20,000. Wrote it up on my simple one-page offer thing, hand-delivered it, drove it over to her office and gave it to her. She sends it to the owners. They moved to Horse Cave, Kentucky, down by Mammoth Cave Park. And she called me up the next day and cussed me out. She really did. Talked like a sailor and all this and that. And like I was evil. And she goes, if I'd have known that, Mike, I'd have bought it. So I offered them $20,000. They accepted it. So we did the closing. So I bought this.
She cussed you out all because they said yes to your lowball offer?
Yeah. Yeah. Classic. She said, okay. So so anyways, we go to the closing, do all that. Then I'm guessing anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks later, I get a phone call from, let's call them Henry and Ethel. They were the ones that owned it. Ethel says, this Mr. Butler? And I said, well, it depends. She says, well, I called my agent, Sam Harden, and she said it was okay if I give you a call. She says, I got a check here from my insurance company for the hail damage back in the spring. Where do you want me to mail that to? What do you want me to do with it?
She's so honorable.
I know. And I said, well, how much is a check for there, Ethel? And she goes, $8,400 and some change. So I said, holy cow, Buckwheat. I said, have you had lunch yet, Ethel? And she said, no. And I said, tell you what, I'll load my daughter up in my Ranger pickup truck. I'll get some Colonel Sanders. We'll come down and have some lunch with you. I want to hear your stories about your house that you lived in for 38 years because I grew up one block over from that. And so I went down there. She signed the check over to me. So now my purchase price went from $20,000 down to $12,000. I still got that butt ugly house today, and it rents for $1,000 a month. And I still own it today. Now, lesson learned here is what I'm getting to. So how many times you walked through a property and you said, no deal, money pit? Here's what I want you to do. Write this down. It's called the Mike Butler Investor Pledge. I promise to myself and my family from this moment forward to make an offer, even if ridiculous, on every property that I take time out of my precious day to go view. If somebody calls you up and said, hey, I hear you buy houses, come out here and make me an offer. Well, if you're going to go out there and look at it,
make them an offer.
You got to make an offer. What kind of an offer? Even if ridiculous. I've had my ridiculous offers has probably made me over $1 million.
You might buy Ethel's house and provide a solution to her needs, which was to get it sold. And then you got to hear her stories too. That's kind of a nice little perk.
Yeah. Yeah. So I like making those folks walk and talking billboards for Mike Butler Real Estate. I enjoyed this and I know we got to get short on time, but this is awesome.
I know my audience has enjoyed it because they haven't listened fast enough. They'll have to go back and listen to it again. And that's fine, friends. That's why these are recorded, so y'all can listen to Mike again. But you might want to go pick up his book. His book, tell me the title again.
Landlording on Autopilot.
Landlording on Autopilot and Rich Dad Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. So those are your two books. And you should probably come back and leave us a comment after you pull them down and read them and let us know where you are on your journey. And learn from Mike so you can get to that 5-hour investor week, but you're going to have to be willing to do the hard work. So that's where we start. It's where we end. Mike, I appreciate you coming on the show and giving us a fire hose of information and ideas and frankly, inspiration so that people can go take that first step and get this going.
Yeah, that is great. Thank you so much. And give them your final words of wisdom.
Subscribe. Give us 5 stars. Check out the show notes and make sure you come back next time because you never know what you're going to find over here on this show.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
As always, I'm so super thrilled that you joined in for more crazy shit. And if you're a realtor, investor, inspector, lender, or just a regular human being who happens to have an unbelievable story that you need to tell the world about, or frankly, you just need to one-up the story you just heard, then make sure to DM me on Instagram at Lee Thomas Brown or tweet me at Lee Brown or frankly, any social network where you hang out. I'm there. And if you had some fun, then you totally want to subscribe so you don't miss out on any future episodes.